You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of December 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show...
И недовольство наших западных партнеров, прежде американских, связано с тем, что мы делаем именно это, а не с тем, что мы...
President Vladimir Putin speaks at his end-of-the-year news conference that lasts over 3 hours. But what does he have to say for himself? Isabel Hilton and James Schneider will give us their views of the message Putin was trying to get across, as well as the other day's main news stories. Then we'll take a look at the stories making the Italian news weeklies in our regular series. David Pleasant, what have you got for us?
We'll be looking at Panorama, that investigates as the climate is changing all over the world. It's also changing in the Alps, and we'll be seeing what the future of snow is in Italy. And then we'll be going to the Espresso and looking at Italian brands bringing manufacturing back to Italy.
So you get a weather report as well, all thrown in. We're also going to look at the nature of political art that's coming back after the Ferguson protests. And we're also going to review the new book releases of the week. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So a lot coming up in the next hour here on Midori House, but before any of that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
President Vladimir Putin says Russia will recover from its current financial crisis within 2 years. He said Russia has adequate reserves and the economy will rebound quickly. Mr. Putin blamed the crisis on external economic factors, mainly the price of oil and gas. Well, Brian Whitmore, senior editor for Radio Free Europe, says Putin was putting on a very brave face.
What we're seeing with this crisis is that Putin's not really the magician we thought he was. What he's been is a very lucky man, and now his luck is running out. He didn't really offer anything so far in today's press conference to change that. The fundamentals don't look very good. Russia's economy is dangerously dependent on oil. The oil price, the long-term trend is down. And Russia's economy is tightly dependent on oil prices, and there's very little Mr. Putin can do about this right now.
Meanwhile, the Central Bank of Russia has raised interest rates to 17% today to try to prop up the ruble. The ruble's instability has led to people cashing in their savings and buying expensive goods before prices go up. Even Russia's ally, the Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko, has demanded that from today, Belarus's transactions with Russia be settled in dollars or euros because of the slump in the value of the ruble. The Boston Marathon bombing suspect Jocko Sanayev, in his first public appearance in more than a year, told a judge on Thursday that he was satisfied with his lawyers as he heads into the January start of his trial in the deadly 2013 attack. Sanayev, who's 21, last appeared at U.S. District Court in Boston in July 2013 when he was charged with killing three people and injuring more than 260 with two homemade pressure cooker bombs at the race's crowded finishing line on the 15th of April of that year. He was also charged with fatally shooting a university police officer 3 days later. Cuba's President Raul Castro and U.S. President Barack Obama have confirmed the surprise reversal of a long-running U.S. policy of isolating Cuba. The White House is to relax travel, commercial and diplomatic restrictions in exchange for the release of Americans and dissidents still held in Havana. Only the U.S. Congress has the actual power to remove the embargo, and observers say many Republicans are still deeply opposed to the move, but the U.N. Secretary General Ban Ki-moon hailed the announcements as a very positive step.
I sincerely hope that these measures, this announcement, will help to expand further the exchanges between the two peoples who have been separated quite a long time. United Nations stands ready to help both countries to cultivate their good neighborly relations.
Israel's Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman today, on a visit to Prague, expressed hope that the Palestinians would return to the negotiating table. He criticized the European Union for being one-sided and also described as a gimmick a Palestinian-proposed UN Security Council draft resolution that calls for a peace deal within a year and an end to the occupation of Palestinian territories by the end of 2017. And as pressure grows from Britain to take action, authorities in the French port of Calais have begun to construct a 12-mile steel and barbed wire fence to secure the port from increasing numbers of illegal immigrants. Britain and France recently agreed to improve border controls to prevent the immigration population, many of whom are fleeing humanitarian crises in Africa and the Middle East, from crossing the channel to Britain. €15 million are being spent on the measures that Britain has agreed to partially finance. Well, Professor François Gamin, a specialist in migration policy, is highly critical of the situation.
At the moment, what is striking is that there is no proposal at all from the European Commission. We don't hear them at all about this subject. And to me, this is one of the biggest European scandals at the moment. It seems that European migration policy is all about the surveillance of borders, but there is no project, there are no ideas, there are no values behind all of that. And I think this is really the biggest scandal in Europe at the moment.
And that's the latest news from Monocle 24.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, eu, London. This is Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, and the time here in London is 18.06. It's 13.06 in New York. And joining me now with their take on the news here in the studio is Isabel Hilton, the editor of China Dialogue, and James Schneider, editorial director at New African Magazine. Welcome both to the programme. The world leaders have congratulated Cuba and the United States for the historic move to end over half a century of hostility between the two countries and restore diplomatic relations. At the same time, Republicans on President Obama's home country, have perhaps unsurprisingly criticised the move. Isabel, we'll start with you. It's an interesting relationship because I guess, you know, Cuba has gone through the kind of, is trying to now go through the journey that China has gone through in the past years as well. How do you restore diplomatic relationships with America? How do you make friends with America? How do you do business with America?
Well, and I suppose like China, you know, the whole process suffered from there being this kind of block of rather recalcitrant opinion inside the US. So with China, it was the China lobby, which was Taiwan and business. And with Cuba, it was the Miami Cubans and any votes that they controlled, plus the right wing of the Republican Party. But honestly, this is a quarrel that has been absolutely irrelevant since 1991, 1992, with the end of the Soviet Union. It really couldn't matter less. And in that period, since the collapse of the Soviet Union, at which point Cuba completely went down the tubes because it lost all its subsidies. And it's been inching back to solvency through this combination of opening up to tourism, opening up to business, big investments from Spain, big investments from Brazil. So, you know, and from China. So it's kind of adjusting to the new reality. And there was just this rather absurd situation in which potentially its biggest trading partner, its biggest investor, had no diplomatic relations with what in the Caribbean had been the biggest and most successful economy. So it was quite anomalous, and it just needed a little political courage, which Obama has now shown since he doesn't face re-election, you know, to break this spell.
And if you just look at the logic of it, Isabel, that, yeah, I guess, you know, if we could make friends, if America could make friends with China, a communist country still, a country which still has questions about its human rights, but it still manages to do business with it and have, you know, a viable relationship. There's nothing more questionable, really, in a way, that's going on in Cuba. Yes, a communist country in theory, certainly still some questions around some human rights, but all in all, there's no reason why if you're friends with China, you shouldn't be friends with Cuba, is there?
There's no reason why if you're friends with Saudi Arabia, you shouldn't be friends with you. I mean, let's look at America's friends. And let's not pretend that ethics are really kind of at the core of this. This was about the fact that Cuba, when Richard Nixon was vice president, which is when, you know, the Cuban Revolution happened, the Cubans were relatively open to a relationship with the United States. Nixon thought, Absolutely not. And they became effectively the Russian toehold in the Caribbean, you know, right in the US backyard at a time when America was fighting proxy wars all over Latin America. So you think of Salvador, Argentina, Chile, you know, this was all about proxy confrontation with the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union doesn't exist anymore. The story is over. So all that was holding it back were some people who are now dying off, actually, who were involved in the failed invasion at the Bay of Pigs and who have and are really the diehards. But, you know, it's irrelevant. Meanwhile, China has virtually bought Latin America. So if I were thinking strategically in the Pentagon or in the White House, I would look at the fact that China's building telecoms all over Central America. I would look at the fact that, you know, some very strange man, clearly with regime ties and ties to the PLA, is proposing a new canal across Nicaragua to rival the Panama Canal.
I believe they're about to start digging in the next
few days.
They're
meant to be breaking ground on the 23rd of December. So there's a whole lot of stuff going on, which is actually about now and not about a battle of 25 years ago. There was one casualty, though, which was the head of USAID, who resigned within minutes of this announcement. And USAID had been sort of carrying on like a slightly headless chicken, trying to undermine the regime through, you know, kind of subverting the band and, you know, Twitter and all that kind of, you know, sort of cultural assault. And clearly had been caught rather unawares by the fact that the policy was about to shift. So he's gone. And I guess, you know, we would hope that we can see a steady improvement.
James, a fascinating situation with Cuba in Africa. They've done two things, which one riled the Americans hugely, which was over the last 30 years, they have kind of popped up in various insurrections and backed various kind of anti-government rebel groups. You know, in Namibia, in Mozambique, going back many, many decades, there would be the hand of Cuba quietly in the background, certainly in the days when the Soviet Union existed. But since then, they've played a more interesting soft power game, which is through education, through supplying doctors. What do you see as Cuba's legacy in Africa, and what do you think this change of policy might mean?
I want to push back quite strongly on the first part of that, the idea that they were backing rebels against sort of legitimate governments. I mean, Cuba supported the independence movement in Namibia when Namibia was an occupied country. It was called Southwest Africa by apartheid regime. They supported the government, which was opposed by apartheid South Africa in Angola, likewise in Mozambique during civil wars where they were fighting against US-backed, apartheid-backed, and also pre-1980 Southern Rhodesian government, which is now Zimbabwe-backed militants. So they actually are considered very positively across most of the continent because those struggles, national liberation, pushing back against white minority rule, is understandably seen as being very positive. And you're right that since then, this sort of strategy of solidarity of various sorts, diplomacy of like for like, rather than going in, because they don't really have the funds to go in like China did historically and then has now go in and build something rather large and call that the sort of the vector of your friendship. But we can see with the Ebola crisis recently, Cuba reacted very quickly and they immediately sent about 160 health workers, which is a thing that the three governments in West Africa were really asking for. They said, what we don't have is health workers. It isn't a lot of the other things which could be sent. And they upped that and I think they're now about 450. And it's interesting that now the way in which those from outside of those, you know, three worst affected countries are being helped is by sending doctors. The UK NHS medical staff have now gone to help. That's also what the African Union has finally managed to organise. So Ethiopia is sent. So they represent an interesting different way of engaging with the continent than sort of China or emerging powers have, or the traditional way that the traditional colonial powers or perhaps we could say neo-colonial powers have engaged, because it is much more based on reciprocity. It's much more based on an idea that we are helping, you know, that our helping you will benefit us later, but there's no direct benefit now. And we do what you ask us to do rather than we're coming in, we're dictating the terms. So, I mean, Cuba, when people think of it, and, you know, often people don't think of it, it's a reasonably small relative to other countries, country in the Caribbean. When people think of it, they tend to think of it across the continent in a pretty positive manner.
So an enriched Cuba, a Cuba that could perhaps do even more, would be seen as a positive thing. Obviously, as we've said, the Republicans don't seem that keen on some of the changes, and some have said they will veto the appointment of any ambassador. But do you feel that this it wouldn't be the end of, you know, Cuba trying to make friends because it needed to? It would still carry on? You feel it's a genuine ambition on their part?
I think if you look, I mean, I don't know an enormous amount about all of Cuba's foreign policy, but with Cuba's foreign policy over the last 50 years on the African continent, it's generally considered to have been not based on an idea like we need to get friends, like, say, Taiwan's has been. Taiwan will go and pick a particular country because it thinks they can buy them to support them rather than China through the UN. That's not really been how Cuba has operated. It's been seen to operate in a much more genuine sense, in a way as in we are a relatively poor developing country that is fighting against some of the same forces that you're fighting against, and we stand alongside you, and we help you where we can, and you can help us where we can. And I don't see that dramatically changing if and when the blockade is lifted and now relations with the US are less extreme. I see that probably likely to continue.
Well, we're going to move on now to a story that has a few echoes with Cuba. We're going to continue with what President Vladimir Putin said today. He said, if the Russian bear sits still, his teeth and claws will be pulled out. That's how the Russian president defended the annexation of Crimea in today's end-of-year news conference in Moscow that lasted over 3 hours. Putin once again accused the US and the EU of conspiring to weaken Russia and denied that his country would pursue an aggressive foreign policy. Isabel, you've seen the speech, you've heard the digest from it. I'm sure you haven't watched a whole 3 hours, but... First of all, there seems to be a sense of denial. First of all, he said, you may call it a crisis if you want to. I'm not sure that's really what it is. A little bit is affected by EU sanctions, but this is just one of those things. You can't stop the Russian economy. 2 years' time will be fine.
You have to remember who he's talking to, of course. I mean, this is primarily for his domestic audience, where he remains, it would appear, pretty popular because of Ukraine. So he's not going to apologise. He's not going to say... essentially, we messed up. You know, the combination of falling oil prices and sanctions is really hurting us. He has to say, it's going to be okay. We're going to get through this. We Russians, we've had terrible times before. You know, Russians do take a pride in their suffering, and it's constantly invoked and remembered. So, you know, this is a nationalist speech. It's a patriotic speech. He's calling people to sort of rally around, you know, Uncle Vladimir, father of the nation or whatever. And so I think that you know, as far as his direct audience is concerned, it was probably pretty much what they wanted to hear. And honestly, as far as the international audience goes, it wasn't as aggressive as it might be. We're fairly accustomed to him blaming outside forces for everything wrong that goes wrong in Russia. I think, though, that Russia is in for a very rough time. I mean, this is an economy which is incredibly dependent on oil. It hasn't diversified in any way. And it remains to be seen what happens to the price. But if the price does stay low, then hard times are definitely coming.
James, do you think there's a get out from this situation for President Putin? If he continues with only the nationalist rhetoric, that means there seems a little chance of any rapprochement with the West. He needs to make some deal. In a way, you can imagine that a blind eye would almost be turned at this point to Crimea if he would make a deal on eastern Ukraine, if he would come to some kind of understanding. But while he doesn't, isn't he just kind of laying Russia open to more and more kind of problems?
I'm not sure he has the option open to him, not necessarily because of how others have acted, but how he has acted historically, to have some kind of rapprochement with the West. And I'm not sure necessarily he'd view that as politically desirable. I mean, the route in which he's going, which is well laid out perfectly, this the revanchist nationalist rhetoric, much tighter control over society, tighter control over politics, tighter control over the media. That is the direction of travel. And I don't think that's actually accidental. I don't think he's necessarily been forced into that by the events in Ukraine. I think they've been running in tandem because they're both in some ways desired. I think he didn't quite understand the possible scope of the economic crisis, which is clearly very grave. and the oil price will have to recover a very long way for it to be the case. I can't remember what the figure is that the
it's over $100 US. Yeah.
The budget balances.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean the oil price has to nearly double for them to be back in the black, which it doesn't look like it's happening necessarily anytime soon. I mean, he doesn't have the get out clauses that way, but he's trying to remake his regime at home. That's what he is able to do now. That's what he's doing. And his logic is not the same as, right, well, we've got this problem, how are we going to fix it? We need the West, so let's make friends. He's trying to see another way out. He's trying to create an entirely alternative, I think, way for Russia to engage with, which is what I think the whole shift to China is about. Now, I think he's deluded if he thinks he's getting a particularly good deal because the Chinese aren't going to give him anything for free. But I think he's trying to, you know, basically stay the course for as long as he can and see where he gets his next room for manoeuvre.
When you look at China, what's extraordinary, they have an amazing trading relationship with America at the moment. And America, you know, recognises that China has some, you know, big foreign policy concerns. And it kind of, it tries to, you know, put a stop to them where it can, but accommodate them where it can. And it knows the lines to be drawn. Do you think that Vladimir Putin is just actually a very bad diplomat? That he could have got more out of America. He could have got more out of the West. He could have laid down the line that, you know, please, you know, this is the end of NATO expansion. This has to be the end to the expansion of the EU, you know, and explained better Russia's fears. You know, Russia has genuine fears. It is being surrounded. Could he have learned something from the Chinese in a way and about how he's run his foreign policy?
I think that he had a different set of possibilities. I mean, the Chinese have essentially set up an economic empire and with great success. So they're far more influential now in what was Soviet Central Asia. They dominate the region, their immediate region economically. They dominate much further afield economically. Australia's now in hock to China. But what they haven't done is gone, since the invasion of Tibet, which is now a long time ago, for physical expansion, except for the confrontations, the maritime confrontations, which they turn on and off, frankly. So if you look at the difference between Chinese economic development and Russia's economic possibilities, Russia's essentially limited to energy supplies and threatening to turn the tap off, which it's done, of course, periodically. But it doesn't have the same, you know, capacity for becoming the largest trade partner of, you know, name a long list of countries as China has done. So it doesn't have that flexibility in its position. And I think that's it's a much smaller economy. It's a much, you know, it's a much reduced country with an ambition to restore its national pride and very limited options. He could have been less aggressive, but honestly, people rather thought that Russia was irrelevant until Putin started throwing his toys out of the pram. So maybe his options weren't that great.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, Isabel Hilton and James Schneider. When we return, we'll continue with a new security bill in Kenya. And we'll also look at Sony's decision to cancel the release of a new comedy film about the North Korean leader.
The idea behind the Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites. We don't want to set up arguments. We just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story, sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was almost worth almost $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Isabel Hilton and James Schneider. Kenyan lawmakers traded blows. The deputy speaker had water thrown on her and documents were ripped up as Kenya's new security bill heated emotions in Parliament today. Proposals in the security laws bill include giving security and intelligence agencies the right to detain terror suspects for up to 1 year, tap communications without court consent, and require journalists to obtain police permission before investigating stories on terrorism or security issues. James, what's going on in Kenya?
A lot of mayhem today. and for some of the day, you could see what was going on live in Parliament, and it was really a kind of ruckus. You could see the parliamentarians on either side trying to push at each other, and then a lot of policemen standing between them trying to stop the fighting. But it is about it looks slightly amusing always when you see politicians actually fighting on TV, but it's about an extremely serious issue, which is that the Kenyatta government has seen a real spike in terrorism and insecurity across the country since coming to office last year, and hasn't really had an answer. And what it's tried to do consistently is push back on critics, push back on investigators, push back on journalists, and try to give itself as many powers as possible. And anyway, it's already acting well beyond those powers if you look at reports into extrajudicial killings, extrajudicial arrests and detentions, rounding up of suspects, and you know, people who are even tenuously related to suspects. And this bill really, it breaches the constitution in many, many places, according to Kenya's own National Human Rights Commission, which is a constitutionally mandated body, which has issued an advisory note on this bill, which just goes through pretty much a litany of places in which it disregards the constitution, disregards the Bill of Rights, completely cracks down on freedom of media, freedom of investigation, freedom of association, freedom of privacy, and it gives carte blanche for the security services to do almost what they like, which is a very troubling turnaround. Obviously, the security is an enormous problem in the country, but it's a very troubling turnaround from just 4 years ago when Kenya passed an extremely progressive constitution, which guaranteed a very large number of rights and a lot of redress, which was seen as a great step forward in the country. And the politicians of the day now are the same ones who were involved with the passing of that constitution. It doesn't seem like it's bedded in very firmly into how they view the world.
And just before we bring in another topic for the bottom of the hour, just tell me, why do they feel so threatened by this? Because investigations should happen, and the media, in a way, can't blame the government solely for this. This is a huge problem, an international problem. It happens to be where the fact that Kenya sits on Somalia's border. Why do they feel so uneasy about the world of journalism?
Well, I think for at least three reasons. I mean, one, they're just not doing a very good job. If you look at the number of the number of attacks that take place, the way people feel that the security service are operating, they're generally disgruntled at how they are operating, and they don't. And the government feels that is then politicized, and they dislike how the opposition get into it, and so they think the media operates on their behalf. The second one sort of dates back in some way to the Westgate shopping mall terrorist attack, where the then head of the police was saying, "We're going to come after you, journalists, for reporting things." And they were very upset and embarrassed because it emerged that the military, when they were in the shopping mall, supposedly dealing with the terrorists, were looting things, were taking things, and things went missing from the shops, and journalists report on that. And this was obviously deeply embarrassing. And then the third element is that it seems like Al-Shabaab in the northeast of the country have managed to build on and exacerbate underlying land tensions that are there. And these land tensions draw from between the Kikuyu group and Swahili group and Somali group. And the reason why many of the Kikuyus are then, Kikuyus are the group that President Kenyatta is from, is that his father moved many of them there. So it's a very personal issue as well for Kenyatta. So the relationship between land and violence is also one which he and other very senior Kenyan politicians don't really want to go into, because they own a lot of it and a lot of places that are fault lines.
We should jump to another story, which is also a bit about freedom of expression, which is this intriguing decision by Sony to drop a film called The Interview. And because it's been threatened by hackers, we've seen what's happened over the last few days with internal papers leaked. Isabel, it's kind of, you know, in a way, these hackers seem to be connected to North Korea. It's extraordinary that a huge organization like this would stop showing a film across America in response to North Korean hackers.
Well, I suppose if you believe that there is a physical threat to cinemas, the last thing Sony wants over Christmas is a cinema blown up while people are watching its movie. It's not, you can see this is negative. What slightly surprises me is that they're not releasing it in any form at all, not even on DVD, because after this, I'm sure that the DVD sales would be quite terrific. I'd certainly, you know, rather curious to see it. And for North Korea, I think it's a win-win. You have the impression that North Korea is a sophisticated, you know, cyber power, which is not something we normally associate with Pyongyang, and they get to claim a victory over a large American stroke Japanese corporation, which will be extremely welcome for internal propaganda purposes. There's a museum, an entire museum in Pyongyang devoted to the Pueblo, which was a captured U.S. spy ship, and you know, this has provided endless propaganda domestically for how North Korea tells the biggest powers in the world to get lost. It's a great victory.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. Isabel Hilton and James Schneider, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 です.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We're going to review some new book releases, we'll leaf through some fresh Italian news weeklies, and we'll also look at political art making a comeback in the US. But before we get started on that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest world news headlines.
Thank you very much. President Vladimir Putin says Russia will recover from its current financial crisis within 2 years. He said Russia has adequate reserves and the economy will rebound quickly. Meanwhile, the Central Bank of Russia has raised interest rates to 17% today to try to prop up the ruble. The Boston Marathon's bombing suspect, Jocko Sanayev, in his first public appearance in more than a year, told a judge on Thursday that he was satisfied with his lawyers as he heads into the January start of his trial in the deadly 2013 attack. Cuba's President Raul Castro and the US President Barack Obama have confirmed the surprise reversal of a long-running US policy of isolating Cuba. The White House is to relax travel, commercial and diplomatic restrictions in exchange for the release of Americans and dissidents held in Havana. And Israel's Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman today, on a visit to Prague, expressed his hope that the Palestinians will return to the negotiating table. And for the moment, that's the latest news on Monaco 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.
Welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. And the time here in London is 18.33, which means it's 16.33 in Rio de Janeiro. And it's time now to look at what's on the pages of the Italian news weeklies, fresh from the printers. Joining me in the studio is Monocle's David Pleasant. Hello, David.
Hello, Andrew.
Where are we going to begin today?
We're going to start with the L'Espresso that came out today. It has a rather lovely cover with an illustration of a train, and the steam of the train is the Italian tricolore. And the title is companies go home, come home. So the story is, the cover story is about Italian brands that are deciding to revert their manufacturing to Italy. So the byline is goodbye Romania, Vietnam, China, hello Italy, basically. And it's asking, are they crazy? No, they've discovered that quality non è un optional.
It's not an option.
Yeah, it's quality.
Look at me, I can speak Italian exactly. as well. Now, what's interesting is we've been covering the story a little bit over the last couple of years in Monocle and on the radio, because this is a process called reshoring, and it's been happening all over Europe, as I think people realise it's difficult to manage the quality of products when they're being produced thousands of miles away from your HQ. And also some companies, I think, are finally realising they need to come true on, you know, that made-in label. So if you turn something over and it's made in Italy, it should really be made in Italy, rather than actually just assembled in Italy.
Exactly. And I think what's interesting, obviously, Italy is very conscious of its made in mark. It's, you know, the quintessential kind of country branding in terms of manufacturing, made in Italy. But it's kind of products that you wouldn't, that a lot of people don't even realise that are made in Italy. The makers of those products are starting to realise, no, actually, it's practical beyond branding. It's practical for the reasons that you mentioned. So from tractors to cheaper clothing to batteries for your car, these kind of products are coming back to Italy, which is quite interesting, as well as things like tinned tuna and all sorts of other things. Whether that's having an impact on the Italian economy at large, that's kind of another question. Obviously, Italy's still in the doldrums, but at least it shows that there is this kind of, you know, good news story about repatriating manufacturing.
And where are we going to head to next?
Next to Panorama, it's rival weekly, the Mondadori published weekly. And there, I thought what was quite interesting, talking about that economy, there's a piece here about the English exception. So a picture of George Osborne smiling at Downing Street. So it's basically saying that the title of this piece is The Gracious State of the British Economy, analysing why exactly Britain is doing so well, whereas the rest of Europe, including Germany, is failing to really get any growth in it. The main kind of reason cites various economists is the reason that George Osborne decided to print money, and also perhaps that Britain was in a kind of better state than a lot of the other countries before the crisis. So they kind of had a head start.
And they don't peg anything to membership or non-membership of the euro.
No, interestingly, that doesn't seem to be much of a reason. Politics is kind of largely left out of this, which is quite surprising because Panorama is a right-leaning newspaper or magazine. Although at the end, the main reason is perhaps the main reason, one of the main reasons for Britain's success, or rather the left's failure, is Labour's Ed Miliband has shown very little propensity for economic terms. So he's kind of economically illiterate, they say. But given that this is a right-leaning paper, they also point out that a recent report says that 4 million people in Britain are in risk of hunger. So it's not all good news coming from Britain.
And I think you've got one. Is that one final story you had the peg there for us today?
That's right. The quite an interesting report still in Panorama. This is the future of snow. So big, huge industry for Italy as the snow season, ski season gets going. Rather kind of disastrous snow. There hasn't been many white Christmases lately. And this is kind of looking at the economics of making fake snow, basically. So there's a big picture of a snow cannon. I think you call it in English. It's certainly called a cannone in Italian.
Yeah, no, you can call it a snow cannon in English as well. I love the fact you don't know the word in English, but you only know it in Italian.
It's a snow cannon, a fake snow maker. A snow cannon, I think, is the word. And it basically, on average, they cost something like €40,000 each. There are 15,000 snow cannons in Italy pumping out the vast majority of snow that skiers ski on. it says the snow industry is enormous. €1 of ski pass that is spent on a ski pass generates another 10. So it's just kind of if you invest in this kind of infrastructure, you get your money back pretty quickly. But still, there is a certain amount of concern as to whether the ski industry or winter sports industry in Italy is sustainable. And there's some look to over the border to Switzerland, where apparently things are a little bit more positive.
Although they've got pictures there with no snow. I think actually the snow's a bit rubbish, apparently, in some parts this year. But anyway, we should have got one for the Christmas market. We could have made even more money.
A snow cannon, exactly.
Yeah, that would be good. Monocle's David Pleasant, thank you very much for joining us. And David will be back over the coming weeks looking at the news weeklies from Italy because he speaks Italian. Anyway, you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Up next, we're going to talk about a new wave of political art. Stay tuned.
On the menu, we explore the delicious, diverse and eminently digestible world of food, drink and hospitality every week. Join me, Marcus Hippi, as I meet everyone from the bakers to the makers who are redefining the culinary landscape.
Many people think that it might be gamey somehow because these are hairy animals that have horns, but it's quite the opposite. I think the milk has a cleaner, sweeter flavor than cow milk.
We'll also head to Kenji's kitchen for a roundup of restaurant reviews, interviews with top chefs and trade secrets with our Asia editor at large, Kenji Hall, in Tokyo and beyond.
The beer market has been changing rapidly for some time now. It seems like almost every month a new pub that specializes in craft beer is opening.
All that and even a dinner party soundtrack recommendation, so your ears are catered for as well as your belly. A healthy serving of the finest free-range fare to sate your radio appetite each week. That's the menu on Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. Art has a long history of political engagement, but until recently, political art hasn't received the same attentions that it once had. Now it seems a new wave of political art is emerging following the international protests over the Mike Brown and Eric Garner cases, where two respective grand juries opted to not indict police officers responsible for the deaths of two unarmed black American men. To hear more, I'm joined on the line from New York by the journalist Rachel Corbett, who wrote about the resurgence of political art in the Art newspaper. Rachel, thank you very much for coming in to see us. I think you should give us a little bit of context. In a way, this came to the surface very sharply during Art Basel in Miami.
Yes, exactly. The decision not to indict the policeman who was responsible for the death of Eric Garner coincided with Art Basel. So a lot of the protests erupted while the art world was, you know, having a very different affair down in Miami. But, you know, I think, you know, my Instagram feed at that moment was, you know, alternating images of Kim Kardashian at parties in Miami and then thousands of protesters in the streets of New York and Chicago. And I could see why, to some, it might seem like the art world was a bit indifferent at the time. But yet a lot of powerful images came out of that moment. You know, you've got the crowds of people with their hands in the air or staging these so-called die-ins where they're lying in the street stopping traffic. And these shots have become some of the most powerful imagery that have come out of the whole event. And then, of course, you've got, you know, also artists making direct responses as well.
And just tell me, what surprises me is how rapid the response has been. You know, so I guess that's the nature of political art, you know, that some of the best stuff happens actually quite quickly after the event.
Well, yes and no. I think we have, like, certainly very clear responses. You've got Damon Davis, an artist from St. Louis, who's wheat-pasting prints of black hands outspread as if in the air on buildings around St. Louis, which he said was a very explicit call to action from people in the area to become more active in the cause. And then in Miami, Petzl Gallery was showing this massive photorealistic drawing by Robert Longo. It showed the Ferguson police force with all of their, you know, all done up in their riot gear and charging forth, you know, like they're fighting the Battle of Stalingrad or something like that. But, you know, so those were very direct responses. But what I thought was actually especially revealing was how a lot of the work looked like it was a response. And as I was researching the article, I was approaching artists, asking them about their response. And in fact, I found out that it had been made several months or even years before, which shows you how long these tensions have been snowballing in America. I can give you an example. One of the most popular and most photographed and Instagrammed works at Miami this year was a bronze sculpture by Hank Willis Thomas, which shows the upper halves of male torsos with their arms raised in the air. It's almost a literal embodiment of the rallying cry right now, this hands up, don't shoot hashtag and, you know, signage everywhere. But in fact, he made that in February, and it was actually a response to a photograph of black South African boys being strip searched at the end of their workday. So the source is actually very different, but the effect right now is the same. It's this, you know, image of humiliation that's been transformed into one of protest.
And Rachel, tell me, I wanted to ask, you know, obviously there haven't been a shortage of things to protest about politically in recent years, but why do you think it's come back to the surface now? Why does it feel a very good moment? Do you think that one of the reasons we haven't had enough political art in a way is that, you know, that the art market is so driven by money and commerce and what looks nice on a restaurant wall these days, that perhaps it's been difficult for some of those grittier subjects to get to the forefront?
I think certainly, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, people think about art they want to live with and, you know, an image of protesters, you know, being beaten by police or something like that. These are very difficult images. It's very hard to sell. It doesn't look good in the dining room, you know. So I think that's definitely true, and I think there's been a lot of cynicism in general, just in terms of trends in aesthetic trends. You know, I don't think that political art has necessarily, you know, had such a resurgence until lately because of general cynicism and an interest in more sort of pop-based, surface-oriented type art, you know,
I also liked about your report was what was interesting was that many of the museums, though, do seem to be wondering how they reflect this new air of, you know, political action.
Yeah, well, I think that's yet to be seen. I think there's some movement on that front. You know, the Missouri History Museum, for example, is salvaging a lot of the street art in Ferguson and will be, you know, restoring it and mounting it in exhibitions to come. I don't think we know yet how it will play out in terms of the larger institutions, but certainly could be, you know, I think we're in a moment.
Well, Rachel, a fascinating report, and thank you so much for joining us today. That was Rachel Corbett, who wrote about the resurgence of political art in the Art newspaper. Okay, it's time for a bit of music. Let's continue with half Finnish, half British artist Ronja. This is her new song, Work Harder. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Time now for our daily arts review. And it's time to turn to books today. And joining me in the studio is Fleur MacDonald, who runs the Omnivore book website. We're going to look at two memoirs by very powerful women. And we're going to start with a woman who had a certain dalliance with a certain president.
Yes. Well,
this is Valerie Trierweiler.
Oh, good. I'm glad you pronounced it before I did. Yes, this is her memoir, or rather her kind of, sort of highbrow kiss and tell. That's the best way I can categorise it. And it talks about her 9-year love affair with the president of France, François Hollande.
Now, when this book came out, it caused a huge stink in France because, you know, it was felt that, you know, she should be discreet in some sense. And she certainly didn't feel that after he'd betrayed her again for another woman, that she should do that. And it was also interesting because she'd always been slightly disliked by the French press and by the international press. She was seen as somebody who had come along and knocked Ségolène Royal out of the way. People weren't sure about her. How does she come across in this book?
Well, to deal with that first, I mean, it did cause a huge stink. And I think it would in England, for example, if Cherie Blair or Samantha Cameron released a kiss, you know, a memoir, we would be shocked because a first lady has a kind of difficult position of having a very public role, but also being required to be silent and to be just stick by her man, which is sometimes difficult to do. Yes, she was hated in France. She explains at length how uncomfortable she felt in front of the cameras and how she felt victimized. And, you know, at the beginning, she starts it off by saying, this is my story, the real story. So she's keen to have a voice. But at the end of the day, the whole book seems like a long justification of what she did wrong and how horrible François Hollande was. It's a bit self-indulgent.
Now, again, when we saw the press stories around this book, you know, she seemed to imply that, you know, he'd been quite a manipulative and not a very pleasant person to be with. Does that stand up in the book, or do you feel it feels a little bit of kind of, you know, settling old scores?
I think both, actually. The start of the book deals with the most kind of damning revelation, which is that when she finds out that he's having an affair, and you've got to think, of course, French presidents, they have affairs. That's what they do. They sink the country, but before that, they have affairs. But she reacts extremely badly and basically has to be sedated. But it's sort of unclear whether the doctors at the hospital administering the drugs against her will, or she actually is having a nervous breakdown. And there's a really uncomfortable suggestion that François Hollande is kind of manipulating the doctor's decision to pump her full of drugs so she can't complain for about 3 months and can't go on state functions. And that's why we didn't really see her right after the revelations of his affair with Julie Gayet.
Now, another woman who's got a new book out, and we should just first of all say, my fault, that book is called Thank You for This Moment by Valerie Trierweiler, and you're not quite sure she really means that. And the second book is called Watch Me, we're going to talk about today, by Angelica Houston. And, you know, without trivialising it, what's interesting, here's a woman who was also betrayed many times by partners, but actually when we think about her, we don't think of her in a tragic sense, we don't think of her in relationship, really to failed relationships. We think of her as an amazing actress, an extraordinary character in the world of film, and actually who's somebody in the end, you know, was bruised by relationships but dealt with them in a quite successful way for her own image and her own kind of mental health. Is that what comes across in the book?
Yes. I mean, whilst Valerie Trierweiler, she comes across badly, and all the men she's with come across badly. Angelica Houston's memoir is a pure joy to read. She comes across as a wonderful person, a wonderful actress. Well, we know that because we've all watched The Addams Family. And she also comes across, and this is what I didn't expect, she is a fabulous writer. I mean, it helps that she's had the most interesting life possible. So every paragraph is littered with anecdotes of meeting Lauren Bacall or Joan Didion or Marlon Brando. Those stories are just so beautifully written. I can't recommend this book highly enough.
And what period of her life does this cover?
So it covers, it starts at the end of her affair with Bob Richardson, who is Terry Richardson, the photographer's father. And he was 24 years older than her and as unpleasant as his son is reputed to be. it starts when she decides to move from LA to New York. And guess what? In the first week, she bumps into Jack Nicholson and starts a 17-year-old love affair, a 17-year love affair. She's not 17, she's in her early 20s, sorry. And it's full of, like, beautiful stories. So, for example, Jack Nicholson, he he had a real thing for giving people nicknames. So she starts off as the Big Fabulous. Then this gets shortened, or no, it gets kind of transformed into German sounding. Nobody knows why, to the Big Fabulous. So he's calling Angelica this. Then it gets shortened even more to the Beak. Then it's to Mine, and then it's to Minor. And it's just full of those kind of those beautiful, true secrets that we want to know, and it makes them sound like real people.
She lifts a veil on her private life. Is there a good explanation of her career as well?
Yeah, well, she's very interesting because she was basically, being in love with Jack Nicholson, as you can imagine, is a full-time job. So she did that for quite a while and it was exhausting. And, you know, she goes to lots of parties, she's a famous model, but she never feels really fulfilled by that. And she has acted before in her father's film, John Huston, but that was a complete failure. And she feels, for the first sort of 10, from in her 20s, she feels totally shy and unconfident. But then at the age of 30, she suddenly decides, I'm going to be an actress, goes to acting classes, and then it begins, and then Prizzi's Honour, where she's the only one to win the supporting actress Oscar.
And this is the second of her memoirs.
Yeah.
So there must be a part three, I presume, after this, if it doesn't bring us up to date.
I think she's got to live that life.
Okay.
And she's not that old. So, yeah, I'm really hoping for that at part three. But to be honest, she's lived so many lives before. So she talks about parties where, you know, she was at Groucho Marx's 82nd birthday party and he sings Animal Crackers to her and then makes a pass at her and then loses consciousness. And that's, you know, that's one party. And then David Bailey proposes marriage to her and she says no because she's in love with Jack. But what's so interesting about it, it's not just kind of a gossip fest. It's really about big movie stars behaving like ordinary people. And who doesn't like to read about that?
Well, Fleur, thank you very much. That book is called Watch Me by Angelica Huston. And I think if you're looking for a last minute gift this Christmas, it's one to pop in the stocking, as it were. Anyway, Fleur MacDonald of the Omnivore Books website, thank you very much for joining us. And that's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests at the top of the show, Isabel Hilton and James Schneider. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie. It was researched by David Pleasant. Jonathan Bartlett and Henry Reese Sheridan and were also on the researchers' stools. And our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Next, after the headlines, it's The Urbanist, presented by Guess Who. Then at 2200 hours, it's the Monocle Daily. This show, well, it's going to be back at the same time tomorrow at 1800 hours London time. For me, Andrew Tuck, goodbye.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.